This is Focus on Our Sages with Rabbi Danny Sackstein on 101.9 Chai FM.
Good afternoon and welcome to Soul to Soul. Wonderful to be with you this Wednesday afternoon. Today I would like to discuss with you the fascinating topic of D-Day. So although we usually talk about our sages in Jewish history, this is one day that is one of the most significant days of the 20th century and had a tremendous effect on the lives of millions of people and was the largest event in the history of the world. Really a phenomenal event that saved Europe from Nazi tyranny and brought an end to the thousand-year Reich and saved, of course, the Jewish people from the clutches and the genocide of the Nazis. And it's a day that I think we should be aware of and has tremendous significance, and the not only the ramifications are vast, but the relevance is powerful for our times too. So let's start out with discussing why D-Day was so important. In terms of a little bit of background, it was D-Day was the 6th of June 1944, which was the 75th anniversary, was just 2 weeks ago. It was quite a large event in the world with many world leaders going to Normandy, to France, and participating in the ceremonies and the tributes to those fallen soldiers. And those, there are still some veterans that are alive, all in their 90s, that landed on those beaches on that fateful day of the 6th of June 1944. D-Day means designated day, and that day was designated for the opening up of a second front in the war against Hitler and the Nazis. As we all know, Hitler took over power in Germany in 1933, and he was a dictator and supreme leader of the German people. And he had great expansionist aspirations. Hitler succeeded in defeating Poland, France, almost defeated England, but was held back in the Battle of Britain. And then he attacked the Russians. And so he was successful in dominating most of Europe. Most of Europe was under the control of the Nazis and their formidable army. And their destructive war machine and their genocide of the Jewish people. So the Allies, he first had a pact with Stalin, and then he betrayed Stalin and he attacked the Russians with the Operation Barbarossa, which initially was very successful, but then it waned in its success. He attacked in June of 1941. He attacked the Russians, and originally the Germans just obliterated the Russian army. But as the supply lines grew longer, and when the Russian winter arrived, so the Germans suffered heavy defeats, and nobody saw the capacity of the Russians in their ability to rearm themselves. The Russian industry is large, and also resupply their troops. In other words, recreate troops. They were able to mobilize millions of men because of the sheer size of Russia. And eventually the tide turned and they pushed the Nazis back. And by 1944, the Russians were back to the original border that they had with the Germans when the Germans attacked them. But Stalin had been pressing Roosevelt, the President of the United States, and Churchill, who was the Prime Minister of England, to open up a new front in order to split the German forces. And a country fighting on two fronts is severely weakened, and that's very difficult to maintain. Originally, Stalin wanted them to attack from the west at the end of 1943, but Roosevelt and Churchill said that our armies are not ready, and so it was agreed upon in 1944 that they would open up a new front. And originally, Stalin wanted the beginning of 44. They said they still weren't ready. They then decided May 44 was agreed upon. And finally, as we know, it took place in June 44. Now, in order for such an operation to take place, you needed a commander of the operation. And the head of the Allied forces on the ground was Bernard Shaw Montgomery, the great British general. The head of the Allied forces in the air was Lee Mallory, who was also a great British general, and the head of the the Navy was Admiral Ramsay, also a great British general, admiral. So, since the majority of soldiers that would be leading this invasion would be American, it made sense that the supreme commander would be American. And everybody thought that originally it would be the chief of staff of the United States Army, who was George Marshall. But Roosevelt said that Marshall was too valuable to him in America. He couldn't do without him. He was indispensable. And so they had to appoint somebody else who would be in Europe and lead this invasion. And the person selected for the job was Dwight David Eisenhower. Eisenhower was one of the superstars in the general staff at that time. He was working in the war office in Washington. Eisenhower successively led the invasions of North Africa and of Italy for the Allies, and so he was well versed in such operations. And Eisenhower was the person, in 1942, he sent Marshall a memorandum saying the only way Hitler would be defeated would be to invade him from the west and to head straight for Germany. And that would be the only way to successfully defeat the Nazis. And so Eisenhower felt very strongly about such an operation and felt that it was necessary in order to defeat Hitler. And so he was the obvious choice to be the supreme commander of the Allied Expeditionary Forces. Eisenhower was a very brilliant person. He was somebody who was a genius in organization. His ability to arrange massive projects and invasions was second to none. Eisenhower was a humble person. He was an excellent briefer. He also had a very short temper. So when subordinates did not fulfill the brief that he gave them, he let them have it. He let them know. But he, all in all, was a very talented and capable person. They say the greatest achievement of Eisenhower was keeping peace amongst all the generals. It's not an easy thing to bring together a lot of high-powered, often eccentric generals and to work together in unison as a team and carry out a successful operation of this magnitude. Now, the Allies, in order to, well, we are running out of time. Time passes quickly. We'll continue with the tactics of D-Day after this break.
This is Focus on Our Sages with Rabbi Danny Sackstein on 101.9 Chai FM.
We're talking about the significance, magnitude, and relevance of D-Day. We've just had the 75th anniversary of the D-Day invasion, and we're discussing how important it was back then, 75 years ago. It was essential to defeating the Nazis and their evil regime that was controlling Europe. The Allies had to develop tactics that would succeed. Now, it wasn't a simple thing at all. The Germans had fortified the western coast of Europe, which was called the Atlantic Wall, and they knew an invasion was coming. They knew that the Allies would have to invade from the west. They knew Stalin was putting pressure on the Allies to do so, and they were prepared. And they set up fortifications all along the western border of Europe, from Norway right the way down to Spain. From the end of 1943 and onwards, they were pouring more than 800 tons of concrete a month in these fortifications. There were more than 3 million bunkers. There were hundreds of thousands of machine gun nests. There were pillboxes that were fortified with steel and concrete, in which there were 88 millimeter guns, 175 millimeter guns. So the Nazis, they fortified that coast because they knew that invasion was coming. Now, the most obvious point for the invasion to be would be to a deep water port, because in order to invade from the sea, one would have to a amphibious invasion, which military experts have known is one of the most difficult operations to carry out. So one would need a port in order to firstly land one's troops and then to supply one's troops and resupply one's troops and to bring in reinforcements. And so the most obvious place would be in one of the major ports in Western Europe. But the Allies had attempted that, and they attempted an invasion in a place called Dieppe, which was led by the British and Canadians that assisted them, and they were totally obliterated. The Germans just slaughtered them, and they were very unsuccessful. The port was so well defended by the Germans that the Allies realized that it's impossible, would be impossible for them to stage an invasion against one of these ports that were defended by the German army. And so they had to look at other options. And the next obvious option would be to land on the beaches of Western Europe and the beaches of France in particular. And, however, that would not be so simple because, as I said, they would need to supply their, land their troops, supply those troops, bring reinforcements. Not a simple thing when you're landing on a beach and you have to deal with the different tides and the large ships can't dock. So the British came up with a brilliant, concept, and that was called a mobile harbor. They called them mulberry harbors, and they developed, components that they would tow across the channel, and they would then be able to build their own harbor, a brand new harbor, at a place of their wish. This was developed by the British engineers. There were large pieces of concrete that they would bring across the channel. There were large pieces of steel, which would be bridges that would connect this port. And this harbor, and they would sink old warships, old battleships, which would be the breakwaters, in order to ensure that the harbor would be protected from the tides and currents of the sea. So once the British had developed this concept and they were able to master it, Eisenhower said that was a real game changer, because now that enabled the Allies to develop a plan where they could land on beaches. And they know that they would be successfully resupplied. And as long as they could establish a beachhead, they could move forward and bring in their army and push back the Germans. And so they had to choose exactly where to do that. Now, if the Germans knew where and when they were coming, they would successfully push them back into the sea. And that was the most critical factor in the invasion of Western Europe. Because Rommel was selected by Hitler, who was one of the top German generals, to fortify their defenses in Western Europe and to build the Atlantic Wall. Von Rundstedt, who was the head of the German army in France and all of Western Europe, was to work with Rommel in this. But they had a disagreement. Von Rundstedt said that they should keep their tanks and their powerful reserves in certain places, and when the invasion takes place, they'll send in the reserves. Rommel, however, had experience dealing with the Allies and battling against the Allies where the German Air Force was almost non-existent. By now, the Luftwaffe wasn't what it was in the beginning of the war. It had been severely weakened by the Battle of Britain, by their campaign in Russia, and so the German Air Force was almost non-existent at this stage, and the Allies would completely dominate the air. So Rommel knew that unless your reinforcements were nearby, any attempts for them to later on join the front lines would be severely hampered by the Allied planes, the Allied bombing runs, the Allied strafing of the guns. And he knew therefore that they needed to be close by. So he wanted the tanks to be on the coast, to be deployed at various places on the coast. And von Rundstedt disagreed with him. Eventually they compromised, and some tanks were scattered along the coast and some were further inland. But most critical were the panzer divisions. There were two panzer divisions that were in France. The panzers were probably the best soldiers that existed in the world at the time. They were crack soldiers. They were battle hardened. They had tanks and heavy artillery, and they were very formidable. If the panzers would arrive quickly after the original invasion, so it would be very unlikely for the bridgehead to be established, and the Allies would be pushed back into the sea. So what was critical was to mislead the Germans and to make them believe that the real invasion was taking place somewhere else in order to give the Allies time to land their troops and to establish the bridgehead. Now, the Allies put a tremendous amount of time and planning into this, into creating this deception against the Nazis. What they did is they had a whole network of spies that the Germans thought were German spies, but really they were double agents. And they were feeding the Germans information that the Allies wanted them to have. It was the elaborate spy network was called Garbo. It was led by a double agent. And he told the Germans that he had a number of agents in the different port cities of England. And the Allies were smart enough to give him real intel, accurate intel, so that would build up his credibility, and the Germans would then see him as a reliable source. And that had been happening over the months of the end of 1943 and the beginning of 1944. And you can imagine making such a decision in the Allied High Command that you're going to give this agent information about certain troop movements, and that means the Germans will attack and kill our soldiers. And that's all in order to build the credibility and to enable for the deception to take place when the real invasion would happen. So, there's some major decisions that were being made by the top Allied generals. Anyway, this network of double agents was very successful. The Germans trusted them and thought that they were reliable agents. And so they were feeding the Germans information that the main attack was going to take place from Dover, would be leaving the port of Dover in England, and would be focused towards Pas-de-Calais, which is the closest place across the channel from England to France. Now, the channel, the English Channel, is notorious for being an extremely rough body of water to deal with, and the weather is highly unpredictable, so it's very, very difficult to stage an invasion across the English Channel. The Germans knew that, and therefore it made sense that the Allies would select the shortest distance in order for the invasion to take place. So over and above this false intelligence that they were feeding the Germans, the Allies also they built a fake army. Today we have fake news, but back then they had fake armies, and they had a blow-up army. They had blow-up tanks and blow-up jeeps and blow-up trucks, and they pretended to mobilize a massive army of over 30 divisions in the Dover area. And it was all untrue. It was all false. You had these blow-up, these huge fields that were filled with these blow-up tanks and jeeps. And when the Germans flew over their reconnaissance flights in order to see if that was true, they took their pictures. They saw these fields and fields of tanks and of jeeps, and they thought that in fact, yes, the information they were receiving that the Allies are building up this massive army was true. Not only that, but the Allies also established a whole radio network of sending radio messages to fake destinations, telling them to move troops and to bring in different amounts of regiments and divisions. And so the Germans were intercepting this radio traffic that was going on all day long, and it was all false. But they had now 3 points of verification that the main invasion will take place in Pas-de-Calais. They had their agents on the ground reporting that that was the case. They had their reconnaissance pictures of the build-up. And they had the radio traffic that they were intercepting. And there was one more piece of the puzzle, and that was the only general in the Allied forces that the Germans feared was General George Patton. Patton was a very strong leader. He was quite an eccentric person, and he was fearless, and he did very maverick, brave things. It was kind of in the style of the Germans. That's what the Germans respected. They saw the Allies, they saw the democracies, they saw the Allied leaders as all being weak, as all being soft, and they wouldn't be able to stand up to the strength of the Germans. Patton, however, in fact, was out of favor in the Allied High Command because he had just slapped an officer. There was an officer who had seen some brutal fighting and was in hospital recovering. He had PTSD, post-traumatic stress disorder. And Patton went to see him, and the guy said, "I can't go back," and he slapped him in the face. And the Allied High Command was very upset, and they therefore sidelined Patton. He wasn't going to be a part of the invasion at all because of this incident. But they used him to pretend to lead this fake army, and he was appearing the whole time in the press, and he was in this area, and it seemed like Patton's Ninth Army was mobilizing in order to lead the invasion. So that was critical. So the Germans, Hitler in particular, was convinced that was going to take place at Pas-de-Calais, and therefore the two divisions of the Panzer troops were stationed over there in Pas-de-Calais, which is quite far from Normandy. So the Allies, Eisenhower and his generals, didn't only have to deal with the Germans and the German defenses, but they also had to deal with the weather, which was a critical factor. As I mentioned, the weather is very unpredictable, and often there are big storms and rough seas in the channel. And there were only 2 or 3 days a month where the invasion could take place. Why? Because the German defenses were such that in low tide, the Germans put in many different obstacles that would sink ships. Most of them were mined, and even if they weren't mined, you know, those big like metal X contraptions. And if it was high tide, the ships wouldn't see them, and they often would puncture the bottom of the ship. So they could only land in low tide, and obviously they had to be very, very gentle waters in order for the landing craft to land the soldiers on the beaches. And before where these obstacles could be seen, that's the only time it would work. So those were limited to a few days of the month where the tides were right, where the moon was right, etc. Now, the original invasion was planned for the 5th of June, 1944. And you could imagine firstly, the logistics involved of coordinating the Air Force and the Navy and the ground troops and all the backup in terms of the logistics of the weapons, of the food, of the medical supplies and the medical, treatment that would be necessary. There were more than 3 million soldiers that were amassing in England for this invasion. And that was all top secret, was undercover. So the soldiers that were in the south of England, and they weren't in the middle of England from where the Germans thought they were coming, that had to be top secret. And so the Eisenhower said that they locked up their troops. Their troops weren't allowed out. They had to remain totally secluded in order to try and keep up the deception. In fact, the British government prohibited any communication between embassies and their governments. So all communication out of the United Kingdom was shut down in order to try and preserve the secrecy. So the date already has been determined as the 5th of June, which was favorable with regards to the tides. On the 4th of June at 6 in the morning, Eisenhower has a meeting of his general staff, of all the top generals, and in comes the top meteorologist of the Allies. His name was Captain Stagg. Captain Stagg tells them that the invasion in 24 hours will be impossible, that there's an absolutely massive storm on its way, and they need to call it off. They look outside. It's quiet. It's calm. They could see stars in the sky. They can't understand what he's saying, but he is the top meteorologist in the world, perhaps one of the top, and so they trust him. Now, a very important factor is that the Allies were able to predict the weather. The Germans were not able to predict the weather because the weather came from the west. Usually, so the Allies had weather stations in Greenland and in Iceland, and the Germans didn't have access to these weather stations. So the Allies knew what the weather was and when it was on its way, that it was moving towards the west. So the Allies could predict the weather, and the Germans couldn't. This storm that Captain Stagg said, and they had to then, so Eisenhower then says, we're calling off the invasion. It's being postponed for 24 hours. Now remember, all of these soldiers are on the ships. Everybody's ready to go. You know, everybody's rearing to go. And he now postpones it for 24 hours. And true to his word, this storm was absolutely massive. Eisenhower says 24 hours later, 6 o'clock in the morning on June, the 5th, when the invasion was due to take place, there was a huge storm, and he said they were in their headquarters in Portsmouth, and the actual building was shaking. That's how strong the wind was and how heavy the storm was. And so they're not sure what to do. Stagg walks into the meeting on June 5th, and he says to them, according to my calculations, there's going to be a temporary lull in the storm. There's going to be a number of hours which are sufficient for the invasion to take place. The window will be from the morning of June the 6th for a number of hours. And so Eisenhower has got a massive decision to make. Does he trust this guy? Right now, the whole world is shaking because there's such a massive storm. And the meteorologist guarantees him, is very confident that there will be a lull for a number of hours. Do they go ahead and carry out the invasion? Now, a lot of the history books say that Eisenhower sat quietly for 5 minutes and contemplated all of the consequences in order to make the decision. But I heard an interview of an Eisenhower, and he says that it wasn't 5 minutes, but it was more like 1 minute. It was 40 seconds to 1 minute. And he thought about it, and he said he thought about the consequences of canceling for the time being. And that means that their secrecy may be broken. And the Germans might find out where the true force is mobilizing in the south of England, which would be catastrophic to the Allies. Or on the other hand, the danger of going ahead and, even though the storm is so strong, for the storm not weakening, and then the invasion also would be a failure. So he had to contemplate all of the many factors that were at play. He thought about it, paused for a minute. And he said, it's a go. We're going for it. And so he said in less than 30 seconds, his office was cleared out and everybody was gone. And so the invasion, the green light is given and off they go. The ships leave. What was the first thing that went in were the paratroopers. The paratroopers left, had to leave in the night. They arrived in the middle of the night because they had a very important role to play in the invasion. Please stay with us. We'll continue with D-Day in a moment.
This is Focus on Our Sages with Rabbi Danny Sackstein on 101.9 High FM.
Talking about D-Day, the magnitude and significance of the D-Day invasion, 6th of June 1944. Eisenhower made the decision, perhaps one of the most important decisions made in all of the history of humankind, and he decides to go ahead with the invasion despite the risks and the uncertainty that was involved. And the first troops that would land in France would be the paratroopers. Now, paratroop battle using soldiers that would fly in behind enemy lines had already begun to emerge at the end of World War I, but the armistice was signed before they actually carried out any operations. It was developed after World War I by the Russians to great success. The Germans were watching the Russians. They saw this and were impressed, and they therefore developed their own paratroop forces. And the German paratroopers also were very successful at the beginning of the war. They were very successful in Greece. They took the island of Crete. There were 10,000 paratroopers against 20,000 defenders. The paratroopers succeeded. They secured an airfield that they could fly in their supplies and reinforcements, and they defeated the defending British and Greek armies in Crete. But Hitler was concerned that the attrition rate, the casualties were too high when you use paratroopers. And so he decided to use the paratroopers as regular infantry. But the Americans and the British saw the value of this, and they developed divisions of paratroopers. The 101st Airborne, the 82nd Airborne were the two big paratroop divisions in the American Army. And they were now entrusted with flying in behind the enemy lines into the coast, just behind the reinforcements of the Germans. And they had two jobs. The jobs of the paratroopers would be firstly to attack the Germans from behind and to try and neutralize the German guns, the big heavy guns that were firing, that were zeroed in onto the beaches, to try and attack them and stop those guns and destroy those guns. And also to prevent German reinforcements from coming and joining the battle, that the paratroopers would ambush the Germans and be a general nuisance to their communication and to their reinforcements. The paratroopers, there were 23,000 paratroopers that were involved in the D-Day invasion. And so Eisenhower, after giving the approval, flies to that afternoon of June the 5th to the airfields in southern England to see off the paratroopers. And there are very famous pictures of him talking to the paratroopers and doing all sorts of interesting things. He met one of the paratroopers who said he's from Missouri. So Eisenhower said, I go fly fishing in Missouri. So this guy says, I'm a fly fisher too. So Eisenhower showed him how he throws his reel in the fly fishing. And everybody was watching this. So people asked him, said, what were you doing? He said, I was trying to make everybody relax and to calm them down in order that they could carry out their mission. Eisenhower stands watching these planes taking off, and eyewitnesses said that he had tears streaming from his eyes watching these soldiers go into battle. He was told by the experts, Eisenhower was told by the British experts, that 7 out of 10 of the Allied soldiers, whether they were paratroopers or infantry landing on the beaches, would be killed by the Nazis. The rate of casualty will be 70%. That's what the experts predicted before the D-Day invasions. Isn't that unbelievable? So here he is talking to these guys, and in his head is that 7 out of 10 of these young, wonderful people are going to be killed tomorrow. At my command, that they were carrying out my orders and my operation. So one could imagine he was very emotional, and that's why he had tears in his eyes when these planes were taking off. What is very significant is that the Germans, because of the severity of the storm of June the 5th, and usually the storms in the Channel lasted a couple of days, the Germans were absolutely convinced that the invasion wasn't going to take place then and would be at a later date. And so they actually took it easy. Many of the officers and generals in the high command were in different places. They were at meetings. Rommel had flown back to Nuremberg to celebrate his wife's birthday, which was on the 6th of June. He wasn't there at the time of the invasion. And so the Germans were absolutely convinced that they had a few days of holiday. They could breathe a little bit because there's no way an invasion could take place when these kind of storms were blowing up in the Channel. Which was, the Allies obviously didn't know this, but it was very much to their advantage that that could play. So we actually see a lot of hashkocha, a lot of divine providence in all of the D-Day invasions, in many of the different aspects, one being that there was a storm, and then the storm weakened for a window that they could carry out the invasion, which took the Germans totally by surprise. And secondly, that the Germans were the deception worked. The Germans still did not expect them to land. Normandy was probably the second or third most likely place for the landing to take place, but they were convinced it would be at Pas-de-Calais. Hitler, being the megalomaniac that he was, refused for any tanks to be released without his approval. Now, Hitler had strange hours. He usually stayed up very late in the night, went to bed at like 4 or 5 in the morning, and he ordered those around him not to wake him up. They weren't allowed to wake him up until midday. So he would sleep late into the day, and therefore everybody's too frightened to wake him when the invasion took place. He only gets up 5 hours after the soldiers already landed on the beaches, and no tanks could be released without his approval. So we see that the high command in Germany was very much centered around the dictator, and that limited the soldiers on the ground in the field, and actually was to their detriment. Whereas with the Allies, they gave a lot of leeway to the officers and to the platoon leaders and to the squad leaders to improvise and make decisions on the ground, which were necessary and significant and effective for the time. And that's exactly what happened. So we see a contrast in the two systems, and the one being much more efficient than the other. So the troops land. As I mentioned, there was a great concern that there would be a very high casualty rate, but it was much lower than they expected. Now, there were 5 beaches upon which they landed. Utah and Omaha were the beaches where the Americans landed, which was furthest to the west. And then there was Gold, Juno, and Sword, which were British and Canadian forces. Now, they all, the waters in Western Europe were all mined. There were millions of mines in the waters. The Germans laid the mines to protect themselves. And so the minesweepers had to open up a channel that they could go through, and then they would fan out and go to the relative beaches, which they did successfully. The landings at Utah, they landed in the wrong place. They were designated to plan to land in one place. They landed quite far away from that place they intended to be, but that was a big brocha. There was a min hashamayim, because the fortifications where they landed were much less than in the place that they had wanted to land, which there would have been a much higher casualty rate. Likewise, on the other beaches of Gold, Juno, and Sword, although the Germans had significant defenses, they it wasn't easy wherever they landed. They were shot at by machine guns, and they were under live fire. nothing was as bad as Omaha Beach. Omaha Beach, where the Americans landed, was very, very well defended, and it was just a disaster. The initial waves were mowed down with target practice for the Germans. They had machine gun fire. They had bigger guns over there, and they just obliterated the first waves. I don't know if you've seen the movie Saving Private Ryan, but that opening scene is depicting what happened at Omaha, and the veterans say that the most accurate depiction of what they experienced was that they've seen on the screen is Spielberg's Saving Private Ryan, which is those opening scenes are brutal, and that's what it was like on Omaha Beach. It was just frightening, and many, many American soldiers were killed. It took them a long time to build up enough troops to push forward to the sea wall with a little bit of protection, and then to break through and push forward to attack the trenches and attack the pillboxes where the Germans were so well fortified. We'll continue when we return in a moment.
This is Focus on Our Sages with Rabbi Danny Sackstein on 101.9 Chai FM.
The part of the, a big part of the D-Day planning was the bombing of the transportation lines in France. The Eisenhower knew that they need to limit the Germans' ability to send reinforcements to the front lines. And so they bombed the railways, they bombed the roads, they bombed a lot of the transportation infrastructure of France. Churchill was reluctant to do so because he was concerned that the French people would be angry, would be resentful for generations to the British and Americans for bombing them. But the leader of the Free French was General de Gaulle, and de Gaulle, who was making regular broadcasts to the French people on BBC and on other radio networks that they were able to pick up, he said to Churchill, if this bombing plan means the defeat of the Nazis and the liberation of France, it's a worthwhile price to pay. And so de Gaulle encouraged them to do so, and in his radio broadcast, he explained to the French people that this bombing was necessary in order to defeat the Nazis. And so the Germans, in fact, Eisenhower was in a major conflict with the leaders of the Allied air forces, because they felt they should be bombing Germany, and that would weaken the Germans, bomb the German industry and the German cities. They would, that would undermine the Nazis. But Eisenhower said, if we don't implement what he called the transportation plan, so the invasion will not succeed. And he actually threatened to walk out unless they gave him the bombers, which Churchill finally did. However, the bombing just before D-Day, the bombing of the German reinforcements, was a great failure, because there was a big cloud bank as they on the coastline on June the 6th. And so they couldn't really find those targets. They missed most of the targets. But most of the time, those dropped their bombs 2 or 3 kilometers inland, and they didn't do any harm at all. So, the bombing was not a success. And likewise, the paratroopers that were landing all over the peninsula, because there was heavy anti-aircraft fire. So as they flew in, there was a big cloud bank. When they cleared the cloud bank, there was a lot of anti-aircraft, and the planes dispersed, and none of them landed on their designated drop zones. They were all scattered all over Normandy, but that was okay. The paratroopers were able to, the Allies were very concerned that there would be a big loss of life for the paratroopers, because there were a lot of German patrols, but they stood up very well, and they played a very critical part in the success of the invasion. The invasion takes place, and it is a great success. And instead of 7 out of 10 soldiers being killed, only 1 out of 10 soldier was killed in the invasion. And it turns out to be one of the greatest, probably the greatest military operation in the history of the world. Now, the significance of D-Day is not to be diminished, because it has great relevance to us today, not only to the fact that they defeated the Nazis. This was the beginning of the end of the Nazis. And Baruch Hashem, as a result of the success of the D-Day invasion, the Allies were able to open up the second front and ultimately ended up penetrating right into Germany and defeating the Nazis. So if that didn't succeed, if the D-Day landings were not a success, so the Nazis would have maintained their stronghold in Europe. And the Nazis were 6 months away of developing their own atom bomb, which is frightening to contemplate, because imagine the Nazis with nuclear weapons. Perhaps we don't know what would have happened if the D-Day would have taken them many more months to plan another invasion. It would have, most probably they would have had to drop a nuclear bomb on Germany, and the Russians then would have, the Russian troops would have conquered all of Europe. So the world would be in a different way. One thing is for sure, their success stopped the murder of Jews. The Nazis would have killed many more, hundreds of thousands or more millions of Jews that were still in Europe at the time. And so the success of D-Day, Baruch Hashem, brought that to an end. But it liberated the world and brought about peace to the world. So I think we should leave with a very relevant and important message that we see from these events. And that is that when you have dictators, when you have totalitarian states and you have megalomaniacs, they thrive when there's weak leadership in the world. When they're not strong leaders in the world, they fill that vacuum and they take full advantage. And that's why we should learn that lesson today, that the policy of appeasement that Chamberlain had resulted in the death of millions of people. And we need to realize that when you have these dictators that are powerful and emboldened by the appeasement of the world, they'll only get stronger and they'll put the world in a more dangerous situation. We need to stand up to these dictators. And, for example, in our modern times, we have Iran that is threatening the world and that is wanting to build nuclear weapons, and in particular is threatening Israel. And if we turn away, and like Obama signed the Iran deal, which was a terrible deal and did not demand anything from the Iranians, and they were not required to step back in any of their plans. So that puts the world in great danger, puts the Jewish people in danger, and puts the world in danger. So I think that strong leadership from the American president, as Trump does have, is very significant to world peace, because Obama said America no longer wants to be the policeman of the world, but without America, which is the biggest economy and the most powerful army, being the policeman of the world becomes a very dangerous place, and it creates an opportunity for megalomaniacs to threaten the rest of the world. We have many Muslim fundamentalists and jihadists that want to take over the world. We have Iran's just one of them. Both Sunni and Shiites, they have aspirations to conquer all of the Middle East and all of Europe. And so without a strong NATO, which Trump has been able to develop, and without a strong America, the world becomes a very dangerous place. And that's one of the most significant lessons we should learn from the events of World War II. And we should learn from the events of D-Day. And to end with, we should have hakaras hatov. We should have appreciation to these soldiers that gave up their lives in order to free the world from Nazi tyranny. There are 10,000 soldiers buried in the fields just above Omaha Beach. And they were cut down in their youth before they could even really begin their lives. We should have great appreciation to them. And please God, we should live in a world where there's peace, where there's respect, and where there is a world where we all strive to respect one another and to build a better world for our children. Thank you for listening. Have a wonderful day.